Welcome to our paranormal afterlife.
This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Baum. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. This week, I'm talking to Jen Scott Pickett about her book, Reincarnation Explained Without Religion: What Happens After Death, Why Some Children Remember Past Lives, and How Reincarnation Really Works. Jen is a writer and independent researcher exploring consciousness, reincarnation, and the nature of identity beyond a single lifetime. She is a certified past life regressionist and hypnotherapist.
Hi, Jen. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hello, Simon. That's so nice of you to include me.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Reincarnation Explained: Without Religion, What Happens After Death, Why Some Children Remember Past Lives, and How Reincarnation Really Works. But before we get into that, is it that you never really were part of some kind of spiritual tradition, the way you were brought up, that had anything to do with reincarnation?
That is correct. And honestly, the reason that I decided to really explore it from the angle without religion is because humans, we verbalize everything. But as you know, from your extensive research with near-death experiences, people are always saying that they can't really put it into words. And I think part of the reason that we struggle with that is because we always have like preconceived ideas of what certain words mean. And reincarnation is one of those words. We automatically think we know what it means, and we put it, you know, with the religious connotations. And so I'm trying to separate it as it is spiritual, but not just as a spiritual or religious, but more like an energy thing. And so I think a lot of modern spiritual teachers or students, we're trying to figure out how to say things that will actually authentically resonate with people differently from their preconceived ideas.
Yeah, because I think you say in the book that there are people who may be very religious who won't look at it because their religion doesn't like it, or there's atheists who won't look at it because they think it's religious.
Exactly. I know Dr. Ian Stevenson had that problem extensively. He'd find so many cases in other countries in the beginning because they were open to reincarnation, that they weren't really interested in his research because they're like, well, we don't need you to prove it to us. We believe. And then in our more Western cultures, we're like, nope, not a thing. You can't prove it no matter what. And it's been really difficult to find that sweet spot of, like, you know, the people who were dismissing it for completely different reasons.
You also say that learning about reincarnation did wonders for your mental health. How did that work?
It did. And it's, again, it's interesting because we all have our individual experiences because we are all individuals. My mother, for example, and she's a very open-minded, kind spiritual person, but she, like others, they think about reincarnation and they get anxiety because they're like, I don't want to come back. This is hard. But for me, I have struggled with a lot of my life being a performer, an overachiever, a perfectionist. And something about reincarnation just resonated with me because it was like, you know what? You don't have to get it all done in one lifetime. You get opportunities to come back. And I was always felt like whatever I'm doing in any given moment, there's something else I could also be doing. And I'm like, how can I be a writer? I could also be a teacher, or maybe I should be an astronaut, or should I be a mom, or should I be this? And it's just so much pressure to, like, to try to fit everything into a single lifetime, which is kind of absurd when you, like, take a step back from it. And it doesn't allow you to, like, enjoy the life you currently have because you're always worried about what you should be doing or what you could have done differently, you know?
Life we're currently living is one that we chose and we mapped out before we were born.
Right. Absolutely. And I find a lot of comfort in that. I feel less alone, if that makes sense.
It's that idea that it's almost like we're putting on a play with other souls and we agree which roles we're going to play in the play. And so
absolutely,
we've got our whole team around us.
Yes. And I think a lot of people, and I interpreted it this way also. In the beginning, a lot of people, when you say that, they feel like you're taking away their choice in the matter. They're like, oh, well, if I planned it in advance, what's the point in being here? I just have to like follow along. And so I like to use the example, and no metaphor or analogy is ever perfect, but it's kind of like, as a writer, you have an outline or you have an idea of where a story is going to go if you're writing something fictional. Or movie scripts, people, they do drafts. So you, on the other side, you do have this plan and it's for a reason and you are working with a team. But when you get here, it's not that you were perfect in the in-between and now you're imperfect and guessing and trying to get it right. You're still learning and expanding and growing and you're applying what you had initially planned. And you have a script maybe, but you can deviate. You're allowed to do that because it's just, you know, the whole point, the expansion is the exploration and the experience. There are some things that you just will not know until you experience them.
And also with the life plan and the experiences, it can go off plans. And that's why sometimes souls may come into the afterlife after they've lived. And it's like their soul team or the council of elders or whoever said, well, you know, you were supposed to be working on this thing and it didn't quite work out. You're going to have to work on it again. You're going to have another life.
Yeah, but there's beauty in that. I think someone in my background with the tendency to like think in terms of right or wrong or justice or being perfect, that's absolutely true. But that, again, that is the gift. That's why I did have less anxiety. I'm like, if it takes 10 lifetimes to get this one particular situation or issue resolved, that's okay because you're not doing anything wrong. It's a little silly for us to expect ourselves to like come into a life, even if we do have a plan, even if we do have people supporting us and think we're going to get everything right in one fell swoop. That's why karma, which I think I'm sure you understand also, is often misunderstood. It's not a punishment. It's an opportunity. That's the most awesome thing about reincarnation to me, is that it is a gift that you can just keep trying and you can just keep experiencing it.
And there is this idea of planning this life that we're living right now. And some people may look at them and think, why did I plan this? This is an awful life.
Right. I think I get that question more than it's just a natural, I think, reaction, a kickback from they're like, there's no freaking way I planned this. Why would I do this to myself? I think Abraham Hicks is the teacher who first pointed this out to me. And they don't even like talk a lot about reincarnation, but they said something that like I've built on over time because I just think it's the most powerful realization. They explained that when you look at your life and you think it's challenging or hard, compare it to like a tennis pro or any other athlete. That athlete who has spent a lot of time developing their skill, they don't want to play a beginner. No offense to the beginner, but they want someone who will challenge them. So when you come into a life that's challenging, it's not necessarily because you're, you know, punishing yourself or like you think you deserve hard things. It's that you feel like you're up to the challenge and your team feels like you're up to the challenge. And again, with that same analogy, the athlete doesn't pick someone just to challenge them. They pick them because they want them to make them better, but they also believe they can handle it. They don't pick someone so they can lose. The goal is not to lose. The goal is to meet the challenge and to be better. And also underlying that, it's supposed to be fun, which we forget that it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like fun sometimes.
Sometimes it does not. That's true.
And you might sit and think, you know, if there's reincarnation, if it's real, then the next life I choose, I'm going to make sure I got a lot of money and it's a really relaxing life. But at the same time, this, what we're living now, is the next one.
Yes. I think it's a great attitude. I think about Jane Roberts. She did the Seth books. And I thought that he did a beautiful example of he said that he had two past lives, one where he was a widow or a poor woman with lots of children. And either her husband had left or he had died. But either way, she was taking care of these children by herself. They were always struggling financially, always hungry. And in another life, he was a priest who basically feasted every night. He always had plenty of food and all his needs were met. Now, it's not that like he was better or holier or more evolved just because he was a priest or because he had money. And it's not that it's more spiritual to be poor. But the point he made is that food tasted so much better in the poor life because he just appreciated it. He was like so eager for it. And when you have something in front of you all the time, you know, like you have access to food and riches, you don't always appreciate them. And it's not that it's wrong to have money or, and it's not that it's right to be hungry because, but the, I think the underlying message is appreciation. That's what makes things better. And sometimes we only learn that in extreme circumstances.
And also there's this thing where you come into life and you try and be good and there's maybe people who's mean to you and they could be really bad. They're such terrible perpetrators. But then that person chose the life as a perpetrator, didn't they? Well, you agreed with them before you were born that they would treat you like that.
I think that part gets very nuanced and I understand why people certainly struggle with that. I think we go into people are always a reflection of us. That's kind of my interpretation of the spiritual teachings and experiences I've had. So it's not that like, okay, you murdered this person in a past life. So in this life, they get to come and like antagonize you or kill you. I think the balancing is more like if you had a situation where a person had so much hatred against you that they could literally take your life. Now you need to put yourself in a position because love, if we believe that love is more powerful than anything, then what do? You put yourself in a position where you're more likely to experience loving that person. So oftentimes perpetrators in one life come back as healers or they come back as a family member because then you just kind of have a default setting where you're more inclined to give that person a chance. But I think where it gets really tricky is that it's really easy for us to make it about the other person. Like you said, they're playing a role. They're reflecting to us. You don't change the perpetrator. You only change yourself. And then your experience with that person changes. It's not like, oh, this person is cruel to me. So like in this life, I'm going to learn to like be cruel too. Sometimes and something I've experienced a lot personally is, I have a history of being a people pleaser. And so I tolerate behavior and I'll acknowledge that this person's not a very good person to me, but the change has to come internally. It's like screaming at your reflection instead of changing your actual image. That person's behavior won't change until I change. And oftentimes that change is like no longer tolerating it, walking away or deciding that you're worth more. It doesn't make that person a bad person. Like you said, they're playing a role, but you're still in control. I think that gets confusing and tricky because everything always comes back to us, and that can be empowering, but that can also feel exhausting and overwhelming. So I do understand why people get anxious thinking about reincarnation and spirituality.
How did you get into reincarnation? Was there one particular thing you heard about, one case that you thought, hang on a second, I got to check this out?
Do you know what? I feel like I have a rather unusual path. I think a lot of people, and again, in your research, I recently read your book, which I highly recommend. I've read so much over the last several years about near-death experiences and reincarnation cases and all these spiritual things that go hand in hand. But I'm always impressed when I read a book that has cases I've never heard. So I will say in your book, I was like, oh, wow, I've actually not heard this one. So that was pretty cool. But in your experience, and in a lot, I mean, as you've seen, a lot of people have some big spiritual experience, like a near-death experience, or a loved one passes away, or something that just, you know, or maybe they just saw ghosts as a child, or they just have an experience that is a wake-up call, which can be wonderful and beautiful and is very common. And I think that's wonderful when it happens. I just happened to have a very different path, which in the beginning I almost diminished because I'm like, you know, it'd be really cool if I could just have, I don't know, a ghost, which I'm always the person, everybody I know who sees spiritual things, they're like, sometimes it feels like a curse or a burden. You don't understand how lucky you are. And I'm the person that's like, no, show me the cool stuff. You know, I've been lucky that in recent years, since I've opened myself up, I have had some cool spiritual experiences to kind of validate my thoughts. But to answer your question, I honestly came to reincarnation from a more logical place. It just became the most rational explanation for me. Throughout my life, there have been seeds planted that I would say, you know, in hindsight, I can see where little things happened to kind of put me on this path. An example being that my youngest son was born with a very odd, dramatic birth defect where his intestines were literally outside of his body. And when you experience that as a parent, you can be inclined to like self-blame. Like, did I do something weird in my pregnancy? Did I accidentally cause this problem? And he's fine now. He recovered. But that was like such a I felt like I had no control that like your kid could just be born with their intestines out of their body and have to have surgery immediately was kind of scary. And that was one seed that kind of led me to exploring what causes birthmarks and birth defects when there's not an obvious scientific explanation. And if anybody is aware of reincarnation, even like on a basic level, birthmarks and birth defects tend to go hand in hand as physical representations of events in past life. So that was one seed. But I will say that when I was younger, I was raised in a very strict religious household. It was Christianity, so it was not reincarnation at all. I was taught that reincarnation was a lie because even though a lot of people don't realize that early Christianity had reincarnation in it, that it was intentionally removed because you can't control a person who feels like they can come back. And so like hell became the new way of threatening people, keeping people in line. People used to literally pay to get their family's soul members out of hell. The church made a lot of money by removing reincarnation. I digress. The point is when I got to more like an adult age and I left religion, I had a lot of resentment I felt like controlled and manipulated. And I was very gun shy and nervous about spirituality, very closed off because I didn't want to be tricked or deceived or manipulated again. So when I started letting other seeds kind of like come to fruition, little weird things that happen or whatever, I watched a documentary that had actual like psychologists and psychiatrists and researchers who were treating spiritual things, consciousness, and you know, we're in a generation now with quantum physics. There are a lot of things people are just more open to. So when I started reading, not just like Dr. Brian Weiss and Michael Newton, but Dr. Ian Stevenson, I would say more than anyone, I was blown away by the meticulous research these people were doing and that no one was talking about. And I guess it was just my bridge between no spirituality and complete religion. And then I just came to the conclusion that this is the most rational answer to every question we have in our human existence.
You mentioned earlier that you've had little experiences. Could you tell us about one?
I've had odd things. I think once you start, I guess, elevating your vibration or a little bit, the veil thins in certain ways. And so you're either more receptive to an audible thing, or you get like a thought that you just know is not from you. I've had some like intuitive moments that were kind of mind-blowing. I tend to get a lot of precognitive dreams or dream symbols that come through that are powerful. That's my probably most consistent avenue. I've met with a few psychics who predicted things that were spot on or that later unfolded in a very beautiful way. I've had loved ones come through in shocking ways. I have dabbled in plant medicine and meditation throughout the years. I have had, I think, probably the most shocking experience for me. And it's much like a near-death experience. It's interesting that you see the parallels with near-death experiences as well as people who remember the in-between state in reincarnation cases, as well as astral projection, lucid dreaming. I've had lucid dreams. So like, it's all they're different and unique, but they're all very similar. I think the experience I had, I was going through a very intense place in life where I was having to walk away from some relationships. And I had up to that point, been telling myself to stay in these toxic relationships because I thought that I was proving that I was like more spiritual or evolved. And what I was realizing that I was just not choosing myself and not tolerating, you know, I shouldn't be tolerating certain behavior to prove spirituality. So I'm in this really interesting place in life. And I go into this deep meditation that just completely took me. My consciousness at first was not in my body, not in an actual projection way. I was in my body at the same time I was out. And then the most powerful moment for me was I blinked up and I saw these colorful lights. And I felt like it was my first spark of consciousness as an individual. And I looked up and I felt the feminine essence of God, like a motherly figure, and the masculine energy was right behind her. But I felt like I was in the arms of what we would call God, which I hate to even say that because, again, people have preconceived ideas of what God means. So whether you want to say it source or source energy or the light or something, something that I came from, all that is, held me in that moment. And I felt my first spark of individuality and how I was still loved, but I was separate. And then I whooshed back into my body. And I have never forgotten that moment. So I think out of all the things I've experienced, that's the one that I come back to when I feel down or hesitant. I'm like, no, I'm at God. It's fine.
So let's talk about children who remember their past lives.
Yes.
When did you first come across that? Which case?
I come back to Dr. Ian Stevenson a lot because I will say that a lot of it's almost like I've like delegated myself. It's like I'm on this personal mission to make sure everyone knows about his research because it's so impressive and extensive. And even though the University of Virginia still has the Department of Perceptual Studies that he used to head up, and they are still exploring all this stuff. I think the average person just isn't aware of it. And so, you know, I think it's wonderful you have these powerful spiritual teachers, and it's wonderful that you have these like doctors and scientists who are taking it seriously. And I just consider myself more of a average student, but like I'm willing to talk about it. And I think a lot of the material that exists on reincarnation tends to be from hypnosis patients. And so now you've got an extra layer because you've got people who have to accept that hypnosis and hypnotherapy is legit, which it is, but because all it takes is one or two cases where people feel like they're not accurate or good enough. And so they'll dismiss every reincarnation or past life regression because of that. So now you're dealing with people having to get through their ideas of hypnotherapy and past life memories. And as we know, a lot of people who have past life regression sessions, it's powerful for them as an individual, but most people go to like a very average life where you can't prove anything. There's not a lot of evidence. What's wonderful about spontaneous past life memories, which tends to happen with children, happens in the East a lot, but is happening more often. I think it's always kind of happened. We're just more open to listening to kids when they talk about their past lives so they don't just get dismissed and like shut up. So the most powerful thing about Dr. Ian Stevenson's research is it's almost exclusively children and it's almost exclusively spontaneous memories. So these are just people who vividly remember their past lives and with a lot of verifiable details and evidence. Like there are children. So, I mean, he personally had about 4,000 cases, and these are only cases that he explored. These are not even cases that that came to him. He didn't take every case that came to him, and then his team and people he works with had taken additional. So we're talking about thousands of cases of children who can tell you, you know, their parents in a past life, where they lived in a past life, their father's occupation, how they died. They have and then they describe all these things, and then the researchers can find a person who matches all the details. And even from it, like statistically, everybody who wants to say that it's coincidence or they're guessing, I'm like, that is the most insane idea to me. Statistically, for a child to get that many hits, it's like, that's crazier than reincarnation to me. But I do have some individual cases if you're looking for, you know, something. One of the cases that this one doesn't have as much verifiable evidence, but it's good fun. It's this little boy was born in a village and as soon as, and most kids, they have the pattern of they start talking by the time they're 1, 2, 3 years old. Most of them move on by the time they're 10. But this little boy had a birthmark on the back of his head, and he would talk about how he was killed and by, I believe it was an axe. And I've read so many of these cases, so bear with me. If there's anything slightly off or inaccurate, there are sources that are they're valid. Some of them blur together. But in this particular case, this kid's in a village. He's got this birthmark on the back of his head. He won't stop talking about how his neighbor killed him with an axe and buried his body. And in this particular culture, I believe it was the Druze, so they were open to it. This kid, who's, again, 2 or 3 years old, he's never left his village, is able to lead a group of people to a village 2 or 3 away, which sounds close, but you have to consider culturally, you know, how insane it is for a child to be able to lead you any place that far. He spots a man walking in the village. He points him out and says, it was him. He's the one who killed me. And everybody's like, is this true? And the guy's like, actually, yeah, the man actually confessed to the crime and was able to take them to the body. The kid who said, this is my past life, that he found his body. The murderer admitted that they had a fight. They were neighbors and had a fight. He buried the man's body. And then the kid's like, but you put the axe somewhere else. And then he took him to a different location for the axe. A lot of people will be like, oh, well, how could the kid know this if he was dead? And that's when you tap into the, as you know, the soul often hangs around after the body so they can witness things in the in-between. So this kid basically found his murderer and convinced his murderer to confess. There are actually a lot of cases. I think there seems to be a pattern when someone dies traumatically, they're more inclined to have past life memories the next time around, which makes sense because even in our regular life, if we have a traumatic childhood, we either completely suppress it or we bring that trauma forward. So that seems to be often a deciding factor for who will remember a past life. And then another story that I think about a lot is this kid who he was born with a birthmark that would bleed, which is just wild to me because open, you know what I mean? Like someone to come forward into a life with a with an open wound like that. What's interesting about his is because his birthmark on his neck would bleed, that it got the most attention. But he started telling everyone about how he was shot by police, the details of what happened, his name, who he really was. And then a few years later, researchers got involved, a different set of researchers got involved, and they had found the person that he matched with who had been shot. And so just out of curiosity, they were like, okay, you have this birthmark on your throat and you say you were shot there. Do you have any other birthmarks? And the guy immediately looks to the top of his head and says, I have another one here. And so those, no other researchers had explored that before, but, you know, the gunshot had basically the birthmark for an entrance wound as well as the exit wound, which is just fascinating because it matched, you know, the deceased body. And that's the, I think, what's the most amazing thing to me is when you're dealing with birthmarks, you're dealing with physical evidence at that point.
Yeah, and I've read of children in Myanmar, where it was Burma at the time, I think, when Evan Stevenson was there, like yes. saying they were a Japanese soldier and they yes. were tied to a tree when they were executed. And in this life, they've got these marks on their arms that look like they were tied up with heavy rope.
Right. Yes, because a lot of these cases, yes, we're not dealing with just like your average birthmark of like a faded light brown spot. We're talking about some of these birthmarks are so extreme, they look like scars. They're like puckered or they're like you said, rope burn or they're bleeding. We're talking about like very dramatic presenting birthmarks, which kind of makes sense because you see the pattern of like, again, you had a traumatic death here, you come back and you've got these vivid memories of how you died and then you have a vivid birthmark. I think most people, we do have birthmarks, but they're faded, much like our memories are faded, probably because either wasn't as traumatic or maybe the karma has been resolved. So it's like faded in comparison. But these kids, they have such vivid memories and such vivid physical defects because of how recent and traumatic that past life was.
Hello, Simon here. I conduct past life regression therapy sessions over Zoom, and these sessions can be very insightful and healing. If you go to my website, pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk, you can book a free 20-minute consultation where we can discuss what it is you would like to achieve. You'll find the link to my website in the show notes. And the kids don't just recount memories. It can be really quite emotional for them, can't it?
Absolutely. And I think this is another thing that is easy to dismiss if you don't have much experience with kids or if you're just looking to gloss it over. But absolutely, these are children who are not just reciting facts. They are identifying fully. You know, they reject the name you give them because they're like, this is who I really am. We're talking about four-year-olds who are crying for their wives and their old lives or their previous children. They don't act they're consumed with need for vengeance on their murderers, or they have phobias that are like cannot be explained in this lifetime. I have several children, and I can tell that you just energetically, you can tell the difference when a child is like having an imagination and like playing or being silly, and when they're telling you something that they actually experienced or really believe. Also with these children, again, they have so many facts that there's no way, they didn't even get the facts from the parents because the parents don't know these previous people. So there's no one to give them the facts, but these kids they're not just reciting facts. And the other thing that's amazing is how often these kids, their story doesn't change. They, over time, they may add more details. Over time, they sometimes forget, and you kind of have to rely on what the adults remember them saying, but their story stays the same, and it's not exaggerated. And it's not like, oh, I was a king. Much like past life regression, their memories are like, I was a baker. I was a mother. There was one little girl, Suzanne, I forget her last name, but she had had an operation in another country. And some of her last words before she died, she was trying to call her daughter Leela or Layla. She was trying to call her on the phone and she couldn't get through. Well, 10 days later, this little girl, I may be wrong about the date, but like soon after this little girl is born and she's a year old and her first like words are she keeps picking up a phone and saying, hello, Layla, so her last words in one life kind of carried over and they're her first words in another life. And in that family, they didn't have anyone, with that name. So as she got older, she would add details and she was like, no, I was married. This was my husband. These are my daughters. I was trying to call my daughter. I knew I was going to die and I wanted to talk to her. Like, that's wild. This is like, how could a child, a 1.5-year-old child, possibly know about this woman, And what my thing is, like, if it's not reincarnation, fine. What is it? Give me an explanation that doesn't just dismiss these children. And so far, no one can do that. So to me, my argument is it's not scientific if you're ignoring the evidence. What is scientific about that? If you can't give me an explanation, fine, but don't just ignore it.
Let's talk about the life between lives space, because that's where all the learning you review everything and see what you've learned from a life and then you plan the next one. So do you have an idea of when somebody dies, what's the first thing that they would do in that process?
Well, there are obviously a lot of patterns and the near-death experiencers seem to have the same type of experiences as people who regress. I know, is it Michael Newton who does a lot of that, the in-between lives, I think?
Yeah.
And I know Dolores Cannon ended up doing a lot of that in her later years. It seems to be very similar with the near-death experiences. I think there's usually a period of disorientation where people, when they first realize they're dead, they're confused and scared because they're still tied to the earthly plane. And it can be a mixture. If a person is, let's say, in physical pain from an injury or an illness, when they are released from the body, obviously there's the relief of not being heavy and dense and in pain. But there can still be some confusion with, I think what surprises people is that their consciousness is the same. Like, you don't lose your personality. Like, you're still you, you're just not in your physical body. And that's why a lot of teachers are now encouraging people to practice lucid dreaming and to practice astral projection and all that, because it's kind of like a warm up so that when you die, you're not as disoriented. But even if you are, it's okay, because at some point you figure it out and there's either a group of beings who love you or your spirit guides or past loved ones who greet you, kind of bring you to the light, or another environment. Seems people experience different versions of the same thing, but they're basically, as you mentioned, with their team, and you're kind of given a life review, which is not about punishing you or making you feel guilty. You're probably going to feel some guilt because you're going to experience, this is what scares everybody, however you treat people, no one gets away with anything, because when you go do your life review, you're not just watching your actions. You will experience what the other person experienced. So, you know, if you, and that again is not a guilt thing, but like every person that you said nasty things to, or you were selfish with, you know, not even about not giving money to the homeless, but let's say like you shunned them or you were unkind to them, you're going to know what it's like to be the person on the other end of that. But on the plus side, every time that you're kind and you're loving and you choose to be a better version of yourself, you get to experience that. And I think a lot of people have described the magical aspect, which can be good or bad, of the ripples, and how any tiny action carries on. I think people are often surprised. I think it was a documentary I was watching recently, and this woman with her near-death experience was surprised because she thought, okay, I've had all these children. I've done these things for the community. I've done all these wonderful things. But the moment that she witnessed in her review, that was like one of the more powerful moments, was she was in line behind a woman who couldn't afford her groceries and was about to put some things back. And she was like, no, let me cover these things for you. And she paid for that woman to be able to have her groceries. And such a small moment that she didn't like overthink. She just did it out of kindness because she had been in a similar position before. And that action, I have chill bumps even now just like thinking about it. That action caused such a huge ripple in that other woman's life. And so I think it's easy to take for granted the little things that we do, good or bad. But you're going to, in that life review, you're going to experience what the other person experienced, and you're also going to see how your attitudes and emotions and your actions affect the world around you, because ultimately we're all connected.
I think that the life review is the most impactful part of a near-death experience. Not that I've ever had one, but it seems that's a real spiritual kick up the ass.
It must be, right? And I think the goal and the thing, so many of these people who have that experience, they come back and they're like, hey, I was supposed to let you know about this. I'm supposed to tell. I think we are more receptive in a lot of ways, but I think it's not, I think the takeaway for us is, yes, of course, we're going to have a life review and it is going to be a kick in the ass and you better be prepared for it. But like, don't wait. Why? You need to be doing it now. Look at your past relationships, your past interactions, and ask yourself, I mean, I like to give myself like a little mini review, check in and be like, hey, am I being, and not out of toxic positivity or like false spirituality, because the great thing about being in the spirit world is you can't hide the stuff the way we have a tendency to hide and kind of fake it as humans. But check in with yourself, do a life review now, and not because you're supposed to be like a servant to everyone else. You are as important as anyone else here. So make sure you're choosing yourself and being kind to yourself, but how you treat people. And again, it's not about giving money to every homeless person you meet. But if you walk by them and your energy that you're sending out is shame or judgment or hatred or even pity, instead of seeing them as just another soul, a lot of homeless people, I mean, the part that's hard for them is not just the physical hunger, but like no one wants to meet their eyes, or if they do, it's with disdain. That's obviously a more extreme example, but I just think keep yourself in check, and not just because you're trying to get the approval of like some deity in the sky, but because your life is going to be more fulfilled. That's how you evolve. That's how you grow. That's the point of reincarnation, is to grow while you're here.
Yeah, and you're here to help other souls grow as well. It's not just about you.
Yes, I'd actually like to talk about that because it's something I've personally been experiencing. It's funny how life, we experience it in a chronological order, but we also experience it in a separate organization. Kind of like I said before, I can see where the seeds were planted that got me here, but they were kind of scattered. One of the first past life regression sessions I did for someone else. Because I'm trained with the QHHT, Dolores Cannon was very big on not just looking for past lives, but kind of like Michael Newton does with the life between life. She was big on like talking to your subconscious or your inner being, or kind of like answering some questions for yourself. And one of the questions I'd asked this particular client led her to an answer that was interesting, because the answer was for her, but like it surprised me because I would have thought with my way of thinking at the time that the answer would have been different. And it was actually something I needed to learn for myself, but like we were kind of helping each other out there. Again, I've kind of had this attitude of spirituality was like, if I'm loving, then I can tolerate this kind of behavior, or I can stay in a relationship with someone who is kind of toxic or whatever. And she was in this session, her subconscious came through and said that the reason that she needed to leave a particular relationship was not to punish that person. It was to choose herself, but it was also because that person needed to learn a lesson, not in a like, I'm punishing you, learn this lesson, but like when you continue to tolerate certain behavior, not only are you doing yourself a disservice, but you are not challenging that other person. You're not holding your end of the bargain. You're not challenging them. You're not being the catalyst for them to grow too. Because if you just keep tolerating bad behavior, they'll just keep doing it. But so sometimes, yeah, we're helping each other in unexpected ways. And so sometimes keeping up your end of the contract is, you know, an unexpected move.
So what do you think of this idea that you could look at your life from a viewpoint of, well, my soul chose this, my soul planned it out, but actually me, as Simon, I didn't choose this, it was my soul.
If there is not, listen, that is one of the biggest mind, and I had this realization recently because I work with dreams the most, and that's like a similar concept that I've been trying to wrap my brain around, because you know sometimes you get it like conceptually, but like fully understanding it like just feels like so hard for our human brains. But I think about how like the dream me is me. When I wake up, I have these memories of these experiences, and I know that it is me in the dream. But when I become lucid in a dream, I am like merging a different consciousness. Because if I just wake up and I have these memories, I'm like, okay, that's me, but like, it's not me. Versus when I wake up in a dream and I'm like, I'm consciously there in the dream, it's a different experience. And I'm trying to understand fully, like, how can these both be me but not be me? If I'm trying to like integrate it. And I think that, you know, we are multidimensional beings and, you know, parallel timelines or probable realities and past lives and future lives, which are all simultaneously happening. And yeah, I think sometimes, again, an oversimplification, but the way that my brain tries to accept it is kind of like if you're writing a book and you're the author. And in your book, you've got, let's say, 10 characters. Well, you are the characters because you created them. You wrote them. But also, you're not the characters. And the characters are separate from you, but they come from you. So I think that this is all just like one creative, like you said, it's a play or a movie or a game. And so your oversoul, your main soul, your inner being, some part that knows more than you do has created you, but you're separate. And that's like the only way that but there's an integration process that happens at some point, which is the point of the reincarnation and why all these people talk about in the in-between, how they're in their soul group and they're like almost merged as one giant light, but they understand that they're separate. So I guess it's like, you know, like a book or an author. You're like it's one book, but there are several characters, or it's one writer. All these characters come from the writer, but they're completely distinct and different from the writer. And I don't know if it helps or makes it worse.
But you also talked about lives occurring simultaneously. And I suppose if you're having a past life regression for healing and you can cut off something that's coming through from a past life, maybe you can do something good for that past life and their existence.
Absolutely. I do believe that. Absolutely. And I'll go back to the writer. You know, when you read a book, you're reading it chronologically, and most of us come to Earth in this human form intentionally. We intentionally focus on a chronological experience, and there's no shame in that. You're supposed to have this experience. But yes, past time is a human concept, and so the time is not real. It's all the spacious present, much like a book. The book exists right now. Everything that's going to happen in that book already exists, but we choose to read it chronologically for the experience. I think that a writer can write and at any time go back and change what they wrote and erase it and change it. So again, an oversimplification, but if time isn't real, we are part of this bigger spiritual energetic energy. So our experiences affect our past lives and our future lives, just like our past life. There's an exchange constantly happening. And yes, the things that we accomplish in this lifetime don't just help us in the future. They help us in the past. And also your next life might be in the quote unquote past. So it's all very weird. It's all very weird.
Yeah, I heard about a guy in a past life regression. He was talking about his death at the age of 91 mm-hmm. from a past life. And it was like he was born in 1958 or something. And then the hypnotherapist thought, well, if he's 91, then that's 2040 something. So he's remembering dying in the future.
Wow. It's fascinating though, isn't it?
Yeah. I heard that Brian Weiss, when he was doing training, one of the last things they do as part of the training is he'd do a group session and take everybody forward to a future life.
I think that's future life, I guess, progression or something.
Yeah. But I heard he had to stop doing it because it's always so depressing.
Oh, goodness. I could see that. I think it's because I think it's all in flux. And so it can be too. Everything can be changed in the future, just like things can technically be changed in the past. But it's such a difficult concept for us. So we really feel like the past is fixed and we're like, well, the future is a little more fluid. But I think because it's all the spacious present, you can't. I mean, what is her name? There was a woman who, not Bridie. There was a woman who, Jenny Cockle, maybe?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She had the famous case where she couldn't let go of her children in a past life. And when she finally found them, they were all like, you know, old. And she would, you know, they're like in their 80s, 90s. And she's like in her 30s, 40s. But she went looking for them. But she actually wrote a book about future lives also. And it's such a fascinating concept. But I think it's kind of like how humans can look at the sky and we think, wow, that's beautiful. But it can also give you that existential crisis because it just feels like our focused consciousness in this life is just, it's so hard to comprehend it. It feels overwhelming.
Could you tell us about a story? I saw you tell this on another podcast. A guy had a near-death experience and he nearly reincarnated into a baby, but then decided not to.
That is one of those cases that I cannot shake because I think I understand what happened, but I don't fully. And so I come back to it often. I like that it challenges this idea of reincarnation timelines because a lot of people are like, well, how can a baby, you know, they expect there to be like a 9-month wait for someone at least, but time isn't real. And so, that case was a while back. I don't know, like maybe the 1930s or it was a long time ago. It was recorded in the newspaper at the time that this youngish guy was walking and I feel like there was construction or something that hit in the head with a stone and he I don't know that he died full, but he like his consciousness left his body and he was witnessing it. He traveled to his parents who had not been notified yet. I think he was present when his, so these are the kind of verifiable details that came out. His consciousness was present when his parents were notified of his accident. His body was, I guess, in a hospital with a head injury, and they didn't think he was going to make it. His consciousness is kind of, I don't think he did the thing that a lot of people do is go as far as the in-between or the light. I think he just kind of stayed tied to Earth. But yeah, he ended up going, finding his way into the home of a neighbor, and it was a woman who was giving birth. And he felt himself being pulled into this baby's body. And he had a hard time fighting it, but he kept thinking about his current mother being by his bedside grieving for him, and he didn't want to leave her. So he basically like forced his way back into his original body. And when he came back to life or whatever, and he was healing several days later, he found out that his neighbor who had actually given birth that day to a stillborn baby. And so he felt like if he had the choice of going into that baby's body and being that new person, or, you know, the choice he made, and that means that the baby didn't survive, which is, there's a lot to process with that story.
Yeah, there is. There's that idea of planning the life and choosing the body and choosing your parents.
Right.
And then he was there and he nearly got pulled into that body. It seems like he wouldn't have done any of that planning.
I think that comes back to the time thing, because it's kind of like when you have a dream, you know that you were in bed for, let's say, 8 hours, and your REM cycle may have only been 15 minutes. So you could say, okay, you know, I technically was only in bed 8 hours, or I was only dreaming for 15 minutes, but you can live years in that lifetime. So time just changes on different planes of existence, I think. That again, your next life might be in the 1800s. So chronologically, you're like, how could I go back to the past to have my next life? But it's because time isn't real. And so, and I will say also, there are some spiritual teachers who talk about there are people because of a traumatic experience who don't do the due diligence. They get impatient because you still have free will. They get impatient and they don't listen to the advice of counsel, and they don't plan their life. And so they are choosing their next life, but they're choosing it kind of haphazardly. And eventually they kind of like a toddler, you know, their souls will kind of get to the place where they start realizing the value of studying and researching. But that's how much I think free will we actually have. But then again, another aspect could be, because we don't really know, we only know what he remembers and what he tells. For all we know, some part of his soul did go and have the planning stage and all that, and then it could have been part of the journey for that baby to be stillborn, because we don't know. I think we've both, you know, we know of cases where a child dies. And it's very easy because of the grief to think this is a bad thing. How could this happen? But oftentimes when a child dies, as hard as it is to grasp, it is intentional. And it's usually, I think it's often a more advanced soul who's like, I don't need a whole lifetime, but I'll dip in and I'll do you this favor. Because for most people, it takes something really huge and unfortunate like that to wake them up to spirituality. You know, you have an atheist who loses a child, some will become angrier, but that could be, for some people, the only thing that'll make them wake up, and because their hope for consciousness to continue is so desperate that losing a child is the only thing that would lead them to even considering, let's say, a medium or the concept of reincarnation, you know. So that's what I think. With that situation, we don't know. Was the stillbirth something that like was important for the other person's life? Or was it just he bailed on the plan because he has free will and he chose, you know, we don't know. That's the fascinating part. We don't know. We're all guessing.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book is called Reincarnation Explained: Without Religion, What Happens After Death, Why Some Children Remember Past Lives, and How Reincarnation Really Works. People can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Absolutely. it is, as you mentioned, it is intentionally short to kind of get to the point. You probably can read it in 2 or 3 hours.
Can people book sessions with you for hypnosis?
I have currently paused taking clients. I am navigating what it would look like to accept virtual clients because most of my following tends to be not local. So I've taken a break so that I can kind of train myself on the possibility of taking virtual clients. So at this time, I'm not scheduling. But if you follow me on social media or you join my subscriber list, then you could be notified if I do start.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hey, I appreciate it. It's been so much fun geeking out over this stuff with you.
This week, I was talking to Jen Scott Pickett about her book, Reincarnation Explained Without Religion. What happens after death, why some children remember past lives, and how reincarnation really works. If you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon, where you get exclusive access to the episode. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And please don't forget to check out my book titled Verified Near-Death Experiences. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.